Hey, Laura, you want to go get some lunch?
Sure.
We should invite the supervisors to get lunch and have a conversation over food.
That's a good idea.
It should be soup. Soup with the soups.
It turns out the rest of the SF Next team likes puns a lot more than I do, so Cynthia's idea is now a reality. I'm Laura Wenis.
And I'm Cynthia Lopez. This week we're celebrating a slight name change for this podcast. It's now SF Next, Fixing Our City. We wanted to highlight the fact that this show is part of the San Francisco Chronicle's SF Next project. As part of that celebration, we're kicking off a new series of conversations with city supervisors over soup. Our goal is to talk to each of the 11 members of the board. We want to talk to them about the problems that the city is facing and what they're doing to make things better.
Our first guest is Supervisor Myrna Melgar, who represents District 7. It spans neighborhood west of Twin Peaks, like Forest Hill, West Portal, the Inner Sunset, and Golden Gate Heights, and also extends all the way down to the waterfront through Stonestown, Park Merced, and Lakeshore. In our conversation, she talks about drug use, housing, and polarization in city government.
This is SF Next, Fixing Our City, and soup with the soups.
On a cold and dreary day, Supervisor Myrna Melgar likes pozole.
So you were saying you do eat your pozole with tortillas.
I do because, you know, it's there. I find it something so comforting to just like roll the tortilla and it's warm and dip it in the soup. And, you know, it's like a whole thing. I'm from El Salvador. Mm-hmm. Chips are not really a thing, you know.
You don't do chips?
Well, you know,
like tortillas,
I mean, of course we eat, but the tortillas in El Salvador are much thicker. They're more like what you would find in a sopa or something. They're that thick, yeah. And that's how you eat it. So it's you don't really fry them. But no, I love all kinds of starch, really. So
why did you choose pozole? Is there like a memory you have about pozole?
Because it's cold. It's cold and rainy.
No, I mean,
and there's very few things that I find as comforting as pozole because it's, you know, slow cooked for a long time and it's, you know, warm and it has the corn in it and then the crunchiness of the radishes, mm-hmm. and the crunchiness of the cabbage. It's just like perfect cold weather soup. You know, if we were in August, I might have chosen something else, but this is just my favorite.
So we put the call out for questions to the supervisors that we're interviewing over soup.
I saw.
And I don't know if you saw the responses, but people like really, really want to talk about overdose prevention and safe consumption sites. There's a lot of people saying that it doesn't really work, that it attracts like more drug use and more drug dealing, that it they don't want it near them. There's, let's see, what else? It is racist and classist to put these sites in low-income areas with high populations of immigrants and BIPOC people, yet that's where they go. What else is there? Fentanyl fumes. People are worried about fentanyl fumes. And then one that I thought was interesting was just a concern about like the volume of people who would need to use it if they were actually enacted, because people need to consume like multiple times a day, each site would have to fit a lot of people per hour. What do you make of these concerns?
You know, I think people are rightly worried about what they see in, you know, Soma, downtown, you know, the Mission. And I think that the things that we are doing and have been doing over the last few years have clearly not resulted in what we intend. But, you know, from a voter's perspective, like, it's not like you keep up with like every loss, you know. So we passed this thing and then things just got worse and worse. And then there was a pandemic. So it was like a confluence of a lot of like really terrible things, right? I will just say that people have come to San Francisco to do drugs always. This is not new, right? I think that the difference is one that the drugs that people are doing are killing them in a much faster, more efficient way. And two, we don't have the housing stock that we used to have, where people who just needed a place to crash for a night or a week could do it. It used to be all over Soma in Mission, there were a lot of SROs that were, you know, privately owned. where people could rent a cheap room, and it was, you know, terrible living conditions, but at least they were inside. And a lot of that has disappeared over the last couple decades.
But at the same time, people using inside these SROs is one of the places where we've seen overdose deaths, because they're not outside with each other. They're by themselves and nobody's there to notice when they turn blue.
Sure. You know, I think it's just there's a lot of newness in our situation that people are looking at and seeing, well, you know, now it's a crisis. And it is a crisis when people are dying and they're dying on our streets and they're killing themselves publicly. And so I am desperate as a legislator to do whatever we can and to try new things. And I think that we should be willing to do that. Is it the only thing? No. I do agree. It's mostly in places where there's lots of immigrants, lots of kids. The Tenderloin is full of kids who are exposed to its violence. You know, if someone's shooting something up their veins, that's going to kill them. That's a violent scene. So I'm fine with trying this and at the same time making sure that it is taken off the public realm. And so that, I think, is the trickier part. Because do you criminalize people? Do you put them in jail if they, you know, fail to go into the consumption side rather than, you know, and I actually don't have those answers, but I think that we should be having that conversation.
The trickier question is, where do you put them? Would you put them in your district over like the objections of neighbors for the sake of having geographic equity in the services?
I wouldn't. And, you know, the reason for that is because, you know, I don't, you know, we don't have that population. It's not part of the community.
Doesn't in make sense to put it
West
there.
Portal. So, you know, I think there's other things that I would put in my district that I'm desperate to put in my district. I've been trying for 2 years to have a safe parking site because we have people living in their vehicles, and it's mostly families. It's mostly Latino families with kids in the public schools who are living up the hill from our secondary water source, which is Lake Merced, with no sewer, electricity, you know, garbage pickup. So I'm desperate to get them into a safe parking site with services. So I would gladly welcome those services and, you know, because those people are part of my community. So to me, it makes sense to have the needs of the community addressed, you know, where they are.
How do you balance that kind of dual responsibility? You have a responsibility to your community, to your constituents, the people who voted for you, your district, but you make laws for the whole city that affect other districts as well. How do you balance those two?
Well, you know, I am an immigrant to San Francisco. My family came here when I was 12 during the Civil War in El Salvador, and this city was really good to us, to my family. So it's not just about District 7, it's about the entire city. And in the Civic Center, where I work, by the way, so I come here, you know, every day, that's where our most important institutions are, not just government, but it's, you know, also all the theaters and the, you know, symphony and the opera and all of the civic institutions and arts institution and the library. And so it really pains me to see all of the investment that we've done in our cultural institutions, you know, be in such poor shape in terms of the streets getting to them. So I think that we're all interconnected. We all have these relationships. We're all part of the city. And even though my primary responsibility is to the people at District 7, I think we all see this and what's going on and are really highly motivated to do something about it. I can't think of a single supervisor who is, you know, not worried about his or her main priority.
Yeah, I think it's more of a question of like, what do you think of the district supervisor system?
I mean, I believe in district supervisors, you know, when I've had the chance to vote on it, that's what I voted for. And I believe in ranked choice voting, you know, so I do think that district elections, which was something that was pushed by Harvey Milk and ushered in, you know, that class of Doris Ward and Carol Ruth Silver and, you know, the first gay Jewish woman, the first Black woman, the first gay supervisor. That's why. And I do think that that's a better system, more representative, and has folks who have connection to the community. I do understand the argument about, you know, having folks who have the whole city, you know, in mind as a priority. There are cities like Boston, right, that have both district supervisors and at-large supervisors or city council. And, you know, that is also, you know, a different system that has, you know, the best of both worlds. But our mayor is supposed to be over the entire city and reflects those things. So
And the Board of Supervisors is often at odds with the mayor.
Often.
What do we do about that?
You know, I am a firm believer in consensus, you know, which is why I'm like the middle point on the Board of Supervisors, because I do think that there's value in talking to each other and learning about differences of opinion. I think that you make better decisions that way. I don't ever think that I have the whole truth and I'm absolutely right about everything. And I am absolutely willing to negotiate with my colleagues because their districts are different.
Is there a way to like make that happen more? I think people see a lot of gridlock at the board where they just see like, okay, it just depends on who has the majority, progressive, moderate, or the board and the mayor are at odds. And so now we end up, for example, with two ballot measures or something like that.
Yeah, you know, I am going to push back against that characterization because I feel like their identity is a lot more complicated in humans and in a city as diverse as ours than just moderate progressive.
We'll let her explain what she means by that after a break. I've been talking with District 7 Supervisor Myrna Melgar. I just asked her about polarization in city government and how, to the public, that seems to create gridlock. Melgar says the city's politics are more nuanced than that.
Yeah, you know, I am going to push back against that characterization because I feel like their identity is a lot more complicated in humans and in a city as diverse as ours than just moderate progressive. Nobody noticed, like, I think this is the first time I'm going to point it out in public, that every single woman on the board got a committee chair assignment. Mm-hmm. And five of the seven committees are now led by women. I do think that women negotiate more easily. I think there's something that we're socialized to do.
That's why the women committee matters.
I think that we are socialized to be more collaborative. Not everyone, of course, right? But I do think that we need more women on the Board of Supervisors. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, you know, folks who have lived experiences, for example, having kids in the public school or having elderly parents, have, you know, a more open relationship to issues around children or seniors or whatever. So I do think that there's a great value in representation.
That brings me to a topic that listeners asked about and that also seems to me like a great reason to have district supervisors, Laguna Honda Hospital.
Yeah.
There's, you know, people can come knocking on your door because it's in your district and be like, what are you doing about this? So what are you doing about this?
So, you know, I have been working my butt off for Laguna Honda since the beginning.
Laguna Honda Hospital is a huge skilled nursing facility. It has about 700 patients, including people with dementia, drug addiction, and other complex conditions that mean they need to live there. Last April, the hospital was found out of compliance by the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, often called CMS. In 2021, two patients had overdosed there, and regulators said the hospital was, quote, in a state of substandard quality of care, end quote. CMS pays for a significant portion of the care provided at Laguna Honda, and decertification would mean those payments stop, and the hospital would likely have to close. For several months last year, patients were being transferred out, which is a potentially life-threatening event for someone whose care needs are so high they have to live at a skilled nursing facility.
The city attorney, the mayor, everyone just started this like heavy lobbying campaign with the federal government because the things that they were asking us to do were against our best interests, against the best interests of the residents of Laguna Honda. The relocation plan was a total disaster. Yeah. And so I got on the phone with all of my friends in the labor movement in LA, all the people who got Javier Becerra to where he is, and asked them to start writing letters in Spanish and to start writing his wife. And, you know, we had this whole campaign. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it was when we mobilized, you know, the Spanish press and all these folks that, you know, we got a much better response. So that worked, you know, mm-hmm. And I think that it was also indicative of us all working together and using whatever assets we had to deal with a political problem while we were also dealing with the technical issues with CMS.
The hospital has been making changes, and the city has reached an agreement with state and federal regulators to continue payments and pause the transfer of residents until May of this year.
So we have gotten a extension till May 19th, and that also coincides with the last survey that they're doing to try to bring up our compliance numbers, mm-hmm. which are actually pretty good in the last couple surveys. So the end of May is when we will know whether we can you know, apply for recertification and get it. So, it, you know, the dates now coincide, which they didn't when it was a February end date. So I'm actually feeling pretty good about it. I think that, you know, it is still not over.
One problem the supervisors as a whole are facing is potential budget cuts on the horizon. With that in mind, I brought up the eye-popping cost of a variety of recent city projects. The most infamous one was probably the single toilet proposed for Noe Valley with a price tag of more than $1 million. A city-approved tent encampment that was established briefly during the pandemic cost around $65,000 per tent per year. And a proposal for cabin shelters estimated each cabin would cost $100,000. I asked Melgar if anything could be done about the cost of these things.
I like geeking out over the code and how it's written and the fees that we pay because it's important. I'm an urban planner. And so the tiny home village that we stood up at the City College site there on Gough Street costs about $30,000 per door. And then,
so how has this happened?
Right. So I think that there's something in those budgets that's not right. So just like with a toilet, right? Once we asked for the budget and started looking at every, you know, line item, all of a sudden it was like, oh no, well, you know, it doesn't really cost that much. We just gave like the upward estimate. And, you know, so I do think that it behooves us to be disciplined. And this year is going to be a really tough budget year. And yeah. I think my colleagues are going to be looking at things a lot more closely.
It is a little bit unnerving to me that like the Board of Supervisors had to go through the budget for these things and be like, where's that coming from? Or where's this coming from? And
but
that's
we didn't,
how you found
though.
You didn't?
Oh, you mean that's how we found, yeah. But yeah. We didn't approve it. So
No. But that you had to like look. Yeah. How do we not know some of these things up front, like going into these situations? And then we're left wondering, like, how on earth does a cabin that costs $30,000 per door, what I think that was less than a year ago, now costs $100,000.
Well, I mean, that's how this system's designed, I would say. That's our job. Because
but you have to do that.
Yeah, and we should do that, you know. And, you know, it's all open to the public as well, right? But it is primarily our job in the checks and balances between the administration and the legislative branch to, you know, check each other.
One thing various branches of government did work together on recently is the city's housing element. This is a plan that cities are required to come up with for how they'll reach their state-mandated targets for housing construction. San Francisco's target is 82,000 units of housing in less than a decade. That's ambitious and a huge increase from recent plans. The city's first proposal for its housing element was rejected by the state as unfeasible, but a revised version was approved by the state and by the Board of Supervisors.
Haters gonna hate, but we did it. And unanimously, right? Unanimously.
I love it.
Only five in the Bay Area, right?
Yeah. And there's, well, that I don't think that's like necessarily a feather in our cap. Everybody else hasn't done it, but we
are. No, I think it is because, you know, I mean, we are sort of a driver of the economy in this, you know, area. By far, San Jose, San Francisco, and Oakland are the municipalities that produce the most housing. So people were looking at us. So I am proud that we passed it.
Do you think we are actually going to build 82,000 units for less than 10 years?
I mean, I think that there's a lot of factors that go into that that have nothing to do with the housing element. Mm. Right now, I have three large projects in my district that I'm trying to like just nurture along because I do believe in them. So there's a Balboa Reservoir.
Yep.
There's Park Merced that got entitled in 2011. And they're supposed to break ground next year. What's going on right now is a bad combination of higher interest rates, really high at labor costs, and stagnant rents, which are good for renters, but for the developers, not so much. So their pro formas are totally off. And so I think that that is much more significant in terms of those 82,000 units than, you know, any regulatory or zoning things that we do. Because we can upzone things and we can do all the streamlining that there is. But if people can't borrow money in a way that, you know, they can pay back after construction, it's not going to happen.
Great. Lightning round. If you were queen of San Francisco, like exalted super mayor of San Francisco, for one day you can make anything happen, what would you do?
I would try to fix our public schools. Yeah. So right now, yeah, I mean, you're giving me superpowers, right? I think that there's very few things that distress me more than what's going on at our public schools right now.
Can you name a proposal from somebody who you usually find yourself politically at odds with that you think was actually a great idea?
Yeah, empty homes tax by my colleague, Supervisor Presson, who I've clashed with on housing stuff often this past year. But I supported that. And I think that, you know, if anything, it should have been bigger, but I voted for it and I supported it.
What keeps you up at night?
Gun violence, that keeps me up at night.
Literally?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, people are really angry right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, coming out of this pandemic, there's a lot of mental health issues and way too many guns. And the past couple of weeks, I actually have woken up. I had a little panic attack a couple nights ago. You know, the Monterey, yeah. You know, the shooting and, you know, the one in Half Moon Bay. And then there was a guy who walked into a Jewish Russian center in the Richmond and started firing. And
what?
All these little Russian Jewish seniors were just like, oh, my God, what do we do? You know, and so, you know, this, and then, you know, the district attorney yesterday decided to press charges against this guy who, you know, like assaulted these Asian seniors in Dolores Park. I mean, I just like, there's so much violence in our society right now and too many guns, you know, and that's the thing that keeps me up because it's hard to think of how are we going to control this, right? It's a bad combination of people coming out of being shut in for 2 years and mental health issues and then the guns. So it worries me a lot.
There were a few more things we wanted to ask the supervisor, but I got too distracted with soup. I wanted to know how she would rate the state of the city right now.
So if I was going to say the grade for the city, like, you know, as like us all together, you know, I would give us, you know, I'd say a B+ because we're awesome and we're so beautiful and diverse. And I love San Francisco, Laura. And we've done so many like fantastic things. And we've been through 2 years of an awful, awful thing that other people also have gone through. So yeah, we're not doing so well in recovering and not as well as others, right? In terms of the city government, I would give us, you know, maybe like a C-. I think that we have not adapted to things. You know, I think our government, you know, is designed for stability, which means that we do things a certain way. You know, there's reasons for that because, you know, there's punishment for, you know, trying stuff and failing, right? Then you're all over the paper, right? So I get why folks are not, you know, open to doing things new. But, you know, I fear that we are just stuck in so many ways, and our inefficiencies and lack of cooperation between departments is, I think, largely due to that.
Last year, SF Next conducted a scientific survey of San Francisco residents to get their opinions on what issues are most pressing for them. We also asked whether they thought the mayor, board of supervisors, and school board were doing a good job. Just 12% of respondents said the board had done a good or excellent job. And I wanted to know Malgar's reaction to that.
Well, it makes me so sad, you know, because I know that, you know, in my office, we work really hard. I think most folks don't quite understand what the Board of Supervisors does. And I fear that, you know, sometimes some of my colleagues get caught up in the performative, you know, aspects of the job. So people think that that's what we do, you know. And so it bums me out that that's the case. And I think that we really should be doing things that people see value in. And I think that what we should do is get back to that, you know, just like the basic life things that San Franciscans find valuable in our Board of Supervisors. If San Franciscans could look around and see a city that's clean and, you know, and that their district supervisor is responsive and is able to get services from our departments in a timely manner and done well, I think that, you know, we would see folks really, you know, believing again.
Well, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, you're welcome. It's so nice to see you in person.
I know.
Yeah.
A rare occurrence.
All right. Can I finish my soup?
Yes,
yeah.
Of course.
We've reached out to all 11 supervisors to have these super conversations with them. So you can expect to hear more interviews like this one in the coming weeks and months. And of course, we'll continue to have regular Fixing Our City interviews and reports as well.
Fixing Our City is part of the San Francisco Chronicle's SF Next project, where we explore how the city will chart its future and address its biggest challenges. Send an email to sfnext@sfchronicle.com. You can also DM us on Twitter. We're at sfnext. I'm Laura Wenis.
And I'm Cynthia Lopez.
Next time on Fixing Our City, Supervisor Joel Engardio shares his thoughts on police staffing, building housing to fight homelessness, and how to properly eat stewed coconut soup. See you next week. Cynthia Lopez produces and reports for Fixing Our City. Gary Baca is our sound engineer. King Kaufman is the executive producer. Jonathan Krim is the SF Next project editor. Fixing Our City is part of the San Francisco Chronicle's SF Next project, exploring how the city will shape its future and tackle its biggest problems. Read stories by our reporters, check out interactive data breakdowns, and find our podcast archive at sfchronicle.com/sfnext. If you have a solution you'd like us to cover or you know about a city that's doing something right, get in touch. Shoot an email to sfnext@sfchronicle.com or find us on Twitter @sfnext.